with a sign reading, "Lower the Drinking Age." Snappy protest rhymes seemed as yet inchoate. Drumming and pogo dancing accompanied the chant, "Stop the war in Afghanistan while we still can." Another speaker came to the podium and said, "Let us bomb the world with housing." One of those McMansions with the lawyer foyer and the cathedral-ceilinged great room could do real damage. Vegetarian demonstrators carried large banners illustrated with vegetables. A carrot was captioned, "Intelligence." Placards in the crowd read, "Killing is bad, poverty is terrible too. Abolish money for a world of sharing." And, "Congress, please keep a cool head." One young man wore a headband scrawled with, "Victory for Chechnya." Another carried a black and red ensign that he said stood for anarcho-syndicalism, a word I didn't think had been spoken aloud since Monty Python and Holy Grail. "Do you work for the police?" the standard-bearer asked. My work shirt and chino's liberal disguise was ineffective. A child of 9 or 10 wearing a "Fuck War" t-shirt harangued some police officers. The officers could not keep straight faces. Most of the other demonstrators were of college age with subdermal ink, transdermal hardware, and haircuts from the barber college on Mars. But people my age were present, too, and beginning to resemble Bertrand Russell, especially the women. Then I saw him, a hippie with a walker, wearing a hearing aid. Sick transit, generation gap. Demonstrators tried to burn an American flag. They had trouble lighting it. Maybe their matches had been taken by airport security, or maybe all the anti-smoking propaganda aimed at the young has come home to roost in a lack of fire-making skills. When the flag at last caught flame, a passerby shoved his way into the crowd. He was a normal-looking man, without great height or bulk. He began to throw punches. He was set upon by 25 or 30 of the anarcho-syndicalists, I guess. There was a momentary geyser of funny clothes, odd hairstyles, and flopping tattooed limbs. The normal-looking man emerged, slightly winded, carrying the remains of the flag and having received a small scuff on the forehead. October 21, 2001. 6 weeks into the war on terrorism, contemporary war seemed to exhibit the vulgarity that Oscar Wilde said would be needed to make warfare unpopular. That is to say, the opening offensive of this war was directed at the quotidian, the workaday, the commonplace, the vulgar, ordinary people working at their daily jobs in office buildings. And common people, not self-exalted jihad warriors, were showing the bravery and making the sacrifices in Afghanistan as well as the United States. Then, in a more Wildean sense of the word vulgar, there came the anthrax contamination. A cow flop of a weapon elicited all sorts of bull in response. On October 20th, the Los Angeles Times devoted 465 column inches to a disease that had sickened fewer people than the corporation that makes the antibiotic by which the disease is cured. Only a few months before, Bayer had withdrawn the anti-cholesterol drug Bayqol after it had been linked to 52 deaths. Fortunately, my family doctor, William Hughes, has expertise in the most virulent aspect of anthrax, publicity. Dr. Hughes is married to ABC White House correspondent Ann Compton. He suggested that I get a ciprofloxacin prescription, lest anyone think I was too low in the journalism hierarchy to receive threatening mail. And indeed, there were threats in my mail, but only the usual ones from Visa, American Express, and the landlord. One of the first anthrax attacks was made against the company that owns the National Enquirer. The company's name is displayed in large letters on its suburban Florida offices. American Media. Supposing that the anthrax contamination is really the work of terrorists, Al-Qaeda may be less sophisticated than we feared. Ah, thought the bin Laden operatives, here is where the American media have their place of headquarters. On the other hand, considering the role of supermarket tabloids in America's life of the mind, Al-Qaeda may be more sophisticated than we thought. Anyway, the media were enormously reassuring, simultaneously telling the public that members of the public won't contract anthrax while giving nonstop coverage to the members of the public who did, will, or might. Then Tom Ridge, the head of the Office of Homeland Security, came on the air, reminding us how much Homeland Security sounds like a failed savings and loan. Didn't Grandma lose $15,000 in a CD when Homeland Security went under? The media also recounted the complete list of symptoms for all three types of anthrax infection, symptoms that correspond to those of the common cold, the flu, a hangover, acne, and eating the church picnic potato salad. According to CNN on October 19th, being infected with the intestinal form of anthrax results in nausea, lack of appetite, and fever. And, if boiling rage counts as fever, so did being on a commercial flight. I had flown on 10 during the 5 weeks after September 11th, owing to an author tour for a badly timed collection of light humorous essays. Not that I'm complaining about being knocked off the medium-well seller list by people who spent 5 minutes with Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law in 1976. Especially not after hearing Publishing World scuttlebutt about a certain Manhattan novelist famous for tales of fashion models and drug excess, whose reaction on September 11th, it's said, was to exclaim how glad he was that he didn't have a book out. Discriminating readers are always glad when he doesn't have a book out. Airport security would soon be turned over to the government so that a federal agency could do the same fine job of protecting the nation in the future that the CIA and the FBI did in early September. Meanwhile, heightened security precautions were allowing airlines to perfect their technique of treating passengers like convicted felons and providing all the transportation amenities usually accorded to smuggled cockatoos. At the Los Angeles airport, I watched as an elderly, arthritic man was forced to remove his buckle shoes and send them through the carry-on baggage X-ray. In Ontario, California, a friend was meeting me at the airport. Of course, he couldn't wait at curbside. He had to circle through the arrivals lane while slugs with valid photo IDs, delivered my checked bags. On the fourth go-round, a policeman stepped into the road and told my friend that if he drove by one more time, he'd be arrested. What caused the giant python lines at airport security checkpoints remained a mystery. An acquaintance, a plastic surgeon who specializes in cranial reconstruction, was returning from a conference on head injuries shortly after September 11th. His hand luggage contained three human skulls. These passed unnoticed through the X-ray screening. Doubtless, all sorts of civil rights must be sacrificed temporarily in times of crisis, but there is no ACLU for comfort and convenience. A generation hence will be living in a world of metal detectors in nudist colonies. Traveling around the country did, however, allow me to see how different regions of America were coping with current events. On October 9th, a local TV anchorman in Washington, D.C. called Islam, using an adjective perhaps left behind by the sudden journalistic shift away from celebrity obsession, the second most popular religion on earth. It has an amazing Q factor, too, that Islam. At about the same time, aided by the Internet, there was a cheerful realization nationwide that Taliban scans perfectly in the Banana Boat song. Come, Mr. Taliban, rid me of Osama. Air Force come and it flatten me home. Cruise missile tomahawk half-ton bomb. Air Force come and it flatten me home. On October 16th, in Austin, Texas, local TV reported that the Austin Fire Department had responded to a call from a household concerning a suspicious package. The sole suspicious thing about the package was that it had been mailed from New York City. On October 19th, a chipper announcer for KFWB Radio in Southern California said, "Anthrax news certainly has Orange County people talking." Later that day, at a lunch in Simi Valley, I was sitting next to someone from the Ventura County District Attorney's Office. He said anthrax alarms were coming in at a rate of 1 every 3 minutes, and that the only practical decontamination response would be to have people get naked and be hosed down. That evening, on the set of a public television book show, T. T.C. Boyle talked about how he had a certain admiration for acts of écotage, but in his fiction he tried to show both sides of the story. He managed never to mention September 11th. I can remember when powdery white substances of sinister origin were doing a lot more damage to America than anthrax had done so far. Circa 1980, America's elite was suffering nasaltage. It emptied bank accounts, wrecked marriages, ruined thousands of careers, and brought the nation to its knees with a soda straw over a glass coffee table. But Attorney General John Ashcroft was very firm in stating that anthrax threats are no laughing matter. Pranks and jests concerning anthrax would be treated as serious criminal actions. Thus, various larval jokes with "you've got mail" punchlines had to be allowed to die before maturation. And the heavy metal band Anthrax was said to be considering changing its name, presumably to chickenpox. Were we as a nation forgetting what our international critics have been saying about us for years? Aren't we supposed to be a big, terrifying country, a Godzilla of capitalism wrecking the globe? Since when did Godzilla flip out because he might have brushed against something in the mailroom while he was devouring Trenton, New Jersey? Since when did Godzilla turn devastating tail and scamper to Mexico to buy Cipro over the counter? I trusted this was a momentary lapse, and I hope that Osama bin Laden was discovering, amid smart bombs and Delta forces in Afghanistan, that America isn't scared. America is scary. The members of Al-Qaeda had gotten dressed up in their holy warrior costumes and gone trick-or-treating at the wrong house. November 26, 2001. Lo! The intrepid Afghan Taliban fighter of warrior lineage ancient. He who had vanquished countless foes, unassailable in his mountain redoubts, imbued with fanatical resolve, possessed by suicidal courage, and who was now running around Mazar-i-Sharif, getting his beard shaved, playing Uzbeki pop music on his boombox, and using Mrs. Afghan Warrior's burqa for a bedspread in the guest room soon to be rented to foreign aid workers. The fighting in Afghanistan was so brief that CNN Headline News had to delete three bars from its Target Terror score to keep the theme music from outlasting the hostilities. The Soviet Union fought the Afghans for 10 years and gave up in ignominious defeat in 1989. What were the Soviets using for weapons? Cafeteria buns and rolled-up locker room towels? The United States dropped a lot of cafeteria buns, or emergency food aid that is very like cafeteria buns, on Taliban-controlled areas. Exposure to American school lunch fare may have been the deciding factor in the radical Muslim demoralization. A country that can make something that dreadful from mere flour, yeast, and water is a country not to be defied. However it was that we achieved victory, achieve it we did, although to what end remains to be seen. One effect of victory, though very temporary, was to make America's elite even more sanguine about armed conflict than they had been during the 1999 air war on Serbia. Surprise! War works after all, read the headline on the Week in Review section of the New York Times for Sunday, November 18, 2001. That same day, the Boston Globe magazine ran a cover story titled, "The New Patriots: College Students Support a Country at War, and So Do Their Vietnam-Era Parents." Of course, there was the possibility that the revived fighting spirit among America's elite had nothing to do with Afghanistan, but was a collateral result of Harvard's first undefeated football season since 1913. I believe Harvard played Mount Holyoke, Smith, Little Dickens Daycare Center, and several Pop Warner League teams, but I didn't check that. Meanwhile, what next for our nation? Would we do, after the Afghan War, as we did after the Gulf War, and just go home, have a recession, and elect some creepy Democratic governor of an obscure state as the next president? Or would we finish the war on terrorism? The U.S. Department of State publication, Patterns of Global Terrorism 2000, seemed to offer ample opportunities for pursuing the latter goal. Iran remained the most active state sponsor of terrorism. It provided increasing support to numerous terrorist groups, including the Lebanese Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Palestine Islamic Jihad, PIJ. Iraq continued to serve as a safe haven and support to a variety of Palestinian rejectionist groups. Syria continued to provide safe haven and support to several terrorist groups. Sudan continued to serve as a safe haven for members of Al-Qaeda, the Lebanese Hezbollah, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, the PIJ, and Hamas. We mustn't forget that this was not a war between Western civilization and the Muslim world. The Washington Post certainly hadn't forgotten. The Post made absolutely no comment about the real or apparent ethnicity of the person quoted in the following item about anthrax, which ran in the Post's November 1, 2001 issue. In hindsight, this has been an escalating event, said Mohammed Akhtar, executive director of the American Public Health Association. We will continue to see new cases of anthrax disease. I was proud of the Washington Post and meant to write a complimentary letter to the editor, but I was too busy phoning in my tip to the FBI. This was not a war between Western civilization and the Muslim world. There was, nonetheless, interesting reading to be done in Freedom in the World, a survey of political rights and civil liberties issued annually since 1955 by the nonpartisan organization Freedom House. Among countries whose populations are predominantly, 60% or more, Muslim, only remote Mali and tiny Benin were rated as free. On a scale of 1, Canada, to 7, God-awful, no other Muslim country received a score better than 3 in political rights and 4 in civil liberties. Would we have to fight all those countries? Or could we just give them a hug? A peace vigil was being held each Saturday at noon outside the town offices in Peterborough, New Hampshire, a few miles from my house. According to the November 15, 2001 edition of the Monadnock Ledger, one week, when it was rumored that CBS might cover the protesters, 45 people showed up. By Saturday, November 17, the peace protest had, in effect, turned into a victory protest, and 8 people were present. There was one sweet-faced, white-haired old lady, and then another who was so much older that she looked as if she might have been doing this sort of thing since the Hitler-Stalin pact. There was a middle-aged man with hair that was both very long and gone from the top half of his head, a middle-aged woman upon whose features smugness had made an extensive and permanent settlement, a young man whose devil-may-care sideburns clashed with his go-to-hell golf pants, and a tweedy professor type who spent the whole vigil reading a magazine. Plus, there was a mom in hand knits, trying to keep an eye on a rapidly fidgeting 8-year-old, and an Asian woman of college age who carried a sign reading, "Retaliate with World Peace." Considering how world peace has gone for people in many places since the end of the Cold War, that's a harsh sentiment. After a while, the Asian woman wandered off to window shop. Most local New Englanders were ignoring the vigil with the perfect obliviousness to all incongruity that has been a New England hallmark since Henry David Thoreau went off to live a hermit's life at Walden Pond, but continued to have his mother do his laundry. Only one fellow, flannel-clad, stopped to argue with the pacifists. "What do you do," the fellow asked, "when they strike the homeland? What if they roll right in here with tanks?" I was about to think, "Good for you," when the fellow went on to say, "But I'll tell you one thing, I've refused to get the anthrax shots they're trying to give everybody." So we see at what level debate about a just war and the natural right of self-defense was being conducted then. The next morning, in a further sign of the times, Boston's WBZ radio played a recorded segment by Martha Stewart detailing the intricacies of flag etiquette. The New York Times Sunday Style section could not resist a bow to the new seriousness, or an Afghanistan hook, even when reviewing the stupidest possible television show. First, network news programs broadcast images of Afghan women removing their burqas. A few hours later, models had peeled away their clothing and were showing off thong panties as ABC broadcast the Victoria's Secret fashion show. and the November 20th, 2001 issue of the National Enquirer had a feature headed, "Even pets are stressed out from terrorist attacks." Here are some of the signs that your dog, cat, or hamster was suffering from the after effects of 9/11. Sadness or glumness. Constant fighting with other pets. Lapses in toilet training. Pet is more needy and constantly seeks attention. Speaking of constantly seeking attention, Bill Clinton showed up to give a talk at Harvard on November 19th, perhaps to share anecdotes about his being a star quarterback on the undefeated Crimson Gridiron squad of warrior lineage ancient. The Boston Globe didn't mention his football heroics, but did give Bill two fulsome stories and a teaser. Fans flocked to Clinton in hub visit. According to the Globe, Bill blamed himself for not building stronger ties with the Muslim world during the 1990s. He said he should have worked harder to support overseas nation-building. In those days of flux and transformation, there was comfort in knowing that some things stayed the same. It was still all about Bill. "America can exert influence," he said, "by admitting its own faults." Interesting source for that advice. "We cannot engage in this debate," Bill was quoted as saying, "without admitting that there are excesses in our contemporary culture." Whether the ex-president was referring to himself or to the Victoria's Secret fashion show was not made clear. During a question and answer period, Clinton said that he supported the creation of a Palestinian state. "It's a good idea. Islamic fundamentalists will need some place to go. Having them all in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip would allow the war on terror to be conducted in a compact area with well-mapped terrain and an excellent road system. As long as the Israelis don't get involved. We wouldn't want anybody on our side who was guilty of premature anti-terrorism." 5. Egypt, December 2001. Hatred between Palestinians and Israelis abides. Arab-led Islamic fundamentalism destabilizes nations from Algeria to the Philippines. The threat of terrorist attacks by Al-Qaeda continues. Also, our cars need gas. It is important to understand Arab culture. Egypt seemed a good place to start. Egypt is by far the most populous Arab state, and although Egypt is a poor country in per capita income terms, its economy is larger than Saudi Arabia's. Historically, Egypt has been the most westward-looking of Arab countries. A Napoleonic invasion, an Albanian pasha named Muhammad Ali, and a British takeover gave Egyptians plenty to look at. The modern Islamist movement can be dated from the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood by an Egyptian schoolteacher, Hassan al-Banna, in 1928. Two of Osama bin Laden's closest aides, Ayman al-Zawahiri and the late Muhammad Atef, came from Egypt, as did Muhammad Atta, who led the September 11th hijackings. And there is this thing called the Arab Street, which various serious people take seriously. In the November 11th, 2001 New York Times, John Kiffner wrote, "It is on just this Arab street that President Bush must fight in his war against Osama bin Laden." On January 24, 2002, Chris Matthews said on the television program Hardball, "America's been fighting another kind of war to win the hearts and minds of the Arab street." And on November 16, 2001, NBC Nightly News reporter Martin Fletcher, broadcasting from Cairo, declared, "The battleground isn't only in Afghanistan, it's here in the Arab street." Well, Cairo has thousands of miles of street. But there's a problem with Egypt. It's been around for 5 millennia. America is only 3 human lifespans in age. I'm an American born and bred, so were my folks, and how could the same small part of America vote for both Rudolph Giuliani and Hillary Clinton? How could any parts of America elect action figure toys as governors? Why haven't they been noticeably worse than other governors? Why is the fastest growing spectator sport in America watching cars turn left? How come I've never heard of anyone, Linkin Park, Ludacris, Outkast, on the Billboard Top 50? Why can't they spell? By what means did the Amazon.com list of bestsellers in 2001 come to contain The Wisdom of Menopause, Self Matters, Look Great Naked, and Body Change, the last by someone called Montel Williams, who is on daytime TV? Have you ever watched daytime TV? Who are these people taking DNA tests to see which one molested the Rottweiler? I don't understand anything about America's culture. What could I hope to learn about Egypt? In fact, quite a bit, before I'd been officially in the country for more than a minute. Coming through passport control, I was detained by a solemn fellow who showed me a badge. In his well-ironed, dressed-down Friday clothing, clean grooming, and chilly politeness, he was the exact counterpart of a Mossad agent who had detained me at Ben-Gurion Airport 8 months before. "I would like to ask you a few questions about why you are visiting Egypt," the solemn fellow said. My tour operator, carrying a placard with my name completely misspelled, swooped in with a great bustle. "We are a prominent Egyptian tourism company, government licensed. This man is a valued client. Tourism is in a ruinous state. Do you even see another tourist? What will become of Egypt's foreign reserve situation?" Although that was all body language, I believe the only thing my tour operator actually said to the intelligence operator was, "He's with me." Away we went. Have your travel agent try that with the Mossad or the FBI. There was another lesson in just the drive through Cairo from the airport on the far east side of town to my hotel by the pyramids in the west. It's the lesson of all swollen capitals in societies with uncompetitive economies. In a competitive society, the economist Friedrich Hayek once said, most things can be had at a price, though it is often a cruelly high price we have to pay. The alternative is the favor of the mighty. The mighty have their seat in the capital. Better stick close to their chair legs and napkins to get a crumb from the mighty's table. Cairo is the largest city in the Middle East and Africa, with more than 16 million people, most of whom were offering to carry my luggage at the airport. And they were more persistent than the secret police. Annex Damascus to Beirut, Baghdad, Kuwait City, Jerusalem, and Riyadh. What a war you'd have. And you still wouldn't get Cairo. Almost a quarter of the people in Egypt live in the city, a long haul from the sea, on the site of an old fort of middling strategic importance, distant from natural resources or any traditional means of creating wealth except the Nile farmlands now under Cairo pavement. Think of a capital of the United States located in a Maryland swamp with 70 million Americans gathered there to be close to Medicare benefits, Fannie Mae, and Small Business Administration loan originations. After 90 minutes in my tour van, I realized, so vast is Cairo, there really is no way across it. At least, no way with my eyes open. The traffic is too scary. We Americans, who invented traffic, are always being startled by the forms into which it has evolved around the world. God, if he's a Darwinian, may be similarly aghast at life. But most foreign driving has the advantage of either brevity in its breakneck pace or safe if sorry periods of complete rest in jam-ups. Cairenes achieve the prolonged bravado of NASCAR drivers while also turning any direction they want in congestion worse than L.A.'s during an O.J. freeway chase. When I could bear to peek, I saw traffic cops, not in ones or twos, but in committees, set up at intersections and acting with the efficiency and decisiveness usual to committees. And I saw a driving school. What could the instruction be like? No, no, Anwar, faster through the stop sign, and make your left from the far right lane. Surely John Kiffner, Chris Matthews, and NBC News are kidding when they use Arab Street as a metaphor for anything in the Middle East. Or, considering the history of the Middle East, maybe they aren't. The bar at the Mena House Hotel in Giza has half a dozen floor-to-ceiling windows, and the view of the great pyramid of Khufu fills them all. A number of people were in the bar. Unfortunately for business, they all worked there. Several waiters craned their necks trying to catch my eye. Across the roomful of empty tables, a musical trio abandoned their classical repertoire and began cracking one another up with jazz noodlings of Woman in Love. Out in the lobby, by the front door, was an unattended metal detector. Every now and then it emitted a merry buzz, and everyone in the bar looked up hopefully, only to see another idle taxi driver on his way to the men's room. I wandered across the street to the pyramid complex, now closed for the evening. Behind a police station was a stable yard with horses and camels kept for foreign visitors who, in better times, when there are foreign visitors, want a shake of Visa card moment on their home videos. There I met Mosa, who presented himself, in so many words, as the Night Mayor of Khufu. He promised a forbidden after-hours tour. "Can we climb to the top?" I asked. "It is forbidden." We walked through an alley, past a large hole in the wall that surrounds the pyramid complex. "Japanese tourists did this," said Musa, "to climb to the top." Has anyone had any success understanding Japanese culture? Musa worked as an unlicensed guide from 8 at night until 2:30 in the morning. He supported, he said, his father, his wife, 3 daughters, his sister whose husband had died, and his sister's child. "I must tell my father there is one tourist in Egypt," said Musa. I asked him about the September 11th terrorist attacks. "Whoever does this ruins my life," said Musa. "I do not know who does this." Perhaps taking my silence as a rebuke, Musa continued, "Maybe Osama bin Laden does this." He warmed to his theme. "Osama bin Laden does the killing in Luxor." Musa was referring to the murder of 58 tourists at the mortuary temple of Queen Hatshepsut in November 1997. And Musa may have had a point. According to Egyptian police, one of the killers, Midhat Mohammed Abdel Rahman, had traveled to Afghanistan and Sudan for terrorist training. "Osama lives in Egypt before," Musa said. "Maybe not, but the family business, Bin Laden Brothers for Contracting and Industry, employs 40,000 Egyptians, and has no respect for Egypt. He tries to destroy our country." We walked across the outskirts of the village of Nazlet as-Saman. The people who helped with the building of the pyramids once lived here. Now the people who help with the gawking do. We went behind the Sphinx into the quarry where pyramid makings were cut 4,600 years ago, and climbed to the edge of the Giza Plateau. There was Khufu, immense, 449 feet high, almost exactly 745 feet on each side. The stones aren't as big as those the Hebrews in the Ten Commandments hauled across the movie screen. The real blocks of granite and limestone are about the size of industrial air conditioning units on strip mall roofs. They look depressingly unfake. You can imagine the awful labor of heaving and pulling these rocks, 2.3 million of them, according to Musa. There is a question that less sophisticated Americans ask, and more sophisticated Americans would like to. Why are the people in the Middle East so crazy? Here, at the pyramids, was an answer from the earliest days of civilization. People have always been crazy. A certain amount of craziness, if not possessed already, can be acquired trying to walk in Cairo. The city is well supplied with sidewalks, but they just take you around the block. You can't step off them because of the traffic. The locals manage to cross streets. I began thinking that Cairenes employ some chapter of the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, which I missed when I was a hippie, that tells them how to keep going after they've been squashed between two trucks. It took me 45 minutes to cross the Shara El Corniche to get to the Nile embankment, and then, rather than try it again, I hiked almost a mile to what I thought was a walkway overpass. It wasn't an overpass. It was a stairway for pedestrian access to one of Cairo's few stretches of expressway. I guess this was installed for those bored with ordinary Cairo jaywalking, a sort of double black diamond run for the Cairo shoe slalom. Later, in a taxi on the same expressway, my driver missed an exit and backed up to it from somewhere beyond the next one. Cairo's buildings are Cairo's traffic in concrete. Every structure seems halfway through construction or halfway through demolition, and some seem to be undergoing both. This is modern Cairo. You can find old stones in the town if you let your tour guide drag you to them. My tour guide, Peter, did his best to show me a first-century Roman fort, the 9th-century mosque of Ibn Tulun, and Saladin's 12th-century citadel. But even the pyramids are as beside the point in Cairo as the Dutch wall is on Wall Street. Essentially all of Cairo is modern. The population was only 570,100 in 1897. The number of residents has more than tripled in the past 25 years. I saw a cement truck, barrel turning, load ready to pour, driving down a Cairo street at 2 o'clock in the morning. The upthrustings and down-tearings in central Cairo's business district look the way they do in every busy place. Or they would, if you could see them behind the profusion of blimp-sized billboards that look the way they do in every busy place. As it turns out, the Nile is just a river in Egypt, not nearly as wide as the Hudson River at the George Washington Bridge. Cairo's rich have river views and live, as most rich do nowadays, in apartment houses of faceless effrontery. The only apparent difference from the apartments of the American rich with river views is that in the Cairo apartments, every single room has a huge chandelier. But the emblematic building of Cairo is the small tower block, 5 or 6 stories designed in a fashion so functional that the Bauhaus architects were lapdogs of ornamentalism by comparison. Slab floors are supported by reinforced concrete posts and beams, like the skeletons of timber-frame colonial farmhouses, and, like colonial farmhouses, the tower blocks tend sometimes to the rhomboid. The spaces between the posts are filled with jumbles of approximately brick-shaped bricks, and punctuated, apparently at random, with little windows and balconies. The outside edges of poured concrete staircases poke through the masonry, their runs and risers making zigzag patterns. Dried oozes of mortar cling to the brickwork. Water pipes and electric wires are tacked onto the outside walls as if in half-hearted, rust-staining homage to the Pompidou Center. In Europe, these myriad domiciles would look like self-storage units for the urban proletariat. In Egypt, concrete mosques are crammed between the tenements and festooned with colored lights as if for Christmas decoration, except no red, just the green of Islam. Commerce hums on the ground floors in shops and restaurants, one called Pizza Hut. Roofs are adorned with the festive dishware of satellite TV. The walls of the little balconies are plastered and painted blindingly cheerful shades of swimming pool blue and lawn chemical green. "Plain exteriors," said Peter, "mean less taxes to the government. Interiors are very often elaborate." And peering into bright living rooms, I could see another emblematic Cairo item, the astonishingly ugly sofa. An ideal Egyptian Davenport has 2 Fontainebleaus, the one in France and the one in Miami, worth of carving and gilt, and is upholstered in plush, petipoint, plaid, and paisley, as if Donald Trump and Madame Pompadour and Queen Victoria and the Doors had gotten together to start a decorating firm. Often, there's a pair of matching chairs. You see the astonishingly ugly sofa everywhere. In the homes of the well-off and the otherwise, in hotel lobbies, office reception areas, furniture store windows, of course, and most spectacularly, on Egyptian television sitcom sets. One actor sits down on it and makes an exasperated face, while the other actors gesticulate comically. I couldn't understand what was going on in Egyptian sitcoms, but I could tell it was more charming than Montel Williams. I got to watch a lot of Egyptian TV, owing to a miscalculation in my attempt at cultural understanding. I had arrived in Egypt in early December, in the middle of Ramadan. Not that Ramadan itself is hard to understand. It's a kind of Lent or extended Yom Kippur with fasting from sunrise to sunset. Nothing is supposed to pass the lips, not even a smoke or a sip of water. And Egyptians, at least in public, observe the rules. Clubs and discos are closed. Coffee houses are empty. People in airport lounges are reading the Quran aloud. I was changing money when the call to midday prayer came from the PA system of the local mosque. The bank guard put his rifle aside, unrolled a rug, and performed his devotions. Fortunately, bank robbers were as pious and made no depredations. But Ramadan also has the aspect of a month-long Thanksgiving dinner with the family. When the sun goes down, everyone rushes home for the iftar feast. Another big meal, suhoor, is served before dawn. There's a bit of Christmas, too, with shopping for toys and clothes to be given to children during the 3 days of Eid al-Fitr, when the fasting is over. Stores are open at all hours of the night, and folks are out in the streets at 3 and 4 in the morning, children in tow. I had been in Egypt for a week before I realized I was a diurnal creature in a nocturnal biosystem. During the hours of daylight, Egyptians are, considering that they're hungry, thirsty, and really want a cigarette, remarkably cheerful. That is, when they're awake. People sleep late. Arriving in Egypt during Ramadan is like arriving in an American small town on a holiday weekend about the time that the bowl games come on. Ramadan is, in fact, Egypt's peak television viewing period. "Best TV land is in Ramadan," I heard an announcer say as I surfed past what might have been an Arabic version of Late Night with Conan O'Brien. The celebrity guests were sitting on an astonishingly ugly sofa. The effusive, jolly ugliness of furniture suits a city that should be depressing, but isn't. And the city should be squalid, too. It's an impoverished metropolis with a population density 3 times New York's. But Cairo is clean, if you don't count a sky that ranges in color from cheap motel bedsheet to frightening diaper. There's little begging, although plenty of, "Where are you from? You buy postcard, okay?" if you look like a tourist, and I do. Nobody is living on the street. The homeless, Peter explained, have teamed up with the lifeless. The city's huge eastern and southern cemeteries are filled with house-sized mausoleums used as houses. The Egyptian government, surrendering to the perennial Cairo housing shortage, has provided the cemeteries with a modicum of water and electricity, a humane version of American big cities just giving up and getting Target to provide the homeless with snappy Michael Graves-designed trash bags to sleep under. According to Peter, there are post-mortem sublets in the so-called City of the Dead. The tenant of record's heirs charge rent to the viable occupants who have to make themselves scarce on holidays and special occasions when bereaved families come to picnic or even spend the night with the deceased. Peter said there have been squatters among the tombs since the 14th century. But the taste for elaborate mausoleums goes back further in Egypt, and so maybe do the squats. Perhaps disaffected experimental colossus carvers, young barley beer addicts, and aspiring scribes with papyrus sheets full of edgy new hieroglyphics had crash pads in the Great Pyramid of Khufu. Peter and I went 10 miles south to Memphis, the capital of Egypt during most of pharaonic times. For 3.5 millennia, Memphis was the most important city in the country. Then, in the 10th century, the Fatimid general Johar al-Rumi pillaged its stones to build Cairo. The dikes were neglected, and now Memphis is gone beneath the silt of the Nile. But the former capital's necropolis, Saqqara, survives, marked by the step pyramid of Djoser. The step pyramid was completed about 2635 BC, Peter said. This was the world's first stone building. I said, in a country that's nothing but stone, with not a tree for miles, surely somebody, the ancient Egyptians, Peter said, built their houses out of mud and their tombs out of stone, to last for eternity. Most of Saqqara has collapsed into rubble. Nearby is the Bent Pyramid. This was the first pyramid of the true smooth-sided type, Peter said. To me, it looked like a monument to middle-aged adultery, an affair begun with an aggressive angle of attack that couldn't be maintained. Apparently, building a pyramid was less straightforwardly Herculean than one might think. Peter explained, though not in these words, that there was more to it than making the top pointy, so that the ancient Egyptians would know when to stop. Peter said the craft of pyramid building required 100 years to perfect, leaving 5 pharaohs under large but irregular piles of stuff. We went into the tomb of Mereruka, son-in-law of Pharaoh Teti, who reigned from 2355 to 2343 BC. This tomb was a mastaba, a flat-roofed stone building with 33 rooms. Peter claimed that only royals were allowed to depict the gods in their burial chambers, so Mereruka decorated his with scenes from daily life. And what a life! Carved onto the walls is a nice-looking family with plenty of household help. Frequent gourmet meals are served. There's surround sound lute playing, many buff dancing girls, and goldsmiths coming up with something to placate the missus. Packs of happy, naked kids, it must have been a progressive daycare center, play tug-of-war and Johnny on the Pony. Travel is as adventurous as anything in an Abercrombie and Kent brochure. Mereruka is shown spearing hippos, probably the bungee jumping of his day. And one whole wall is devoted to a lively illustration of revenue enhancement. SERF personnel are, to put it in Enron terms, allowing their 401ks to be used to purchase the corporation's own stock at the urging of supervisors with sticks. Mereruka did well for himself while his wife's dad was running the show. I was looking at a recognizable yuppie paradise. Nothing here would have been strange to the Reagan merger and acquisition years, or the dot-com boom. All it lacked was golf. And yet, I was also looking at 33 rooms of tomb, every one of which was to be filled with custom-made furniture, precious jewels, designer-label kilts and sandals, supermodel-endorsed eye coal, vintage Grand Cru palm sap wine, and enough meals to go to last forever, not to mention archaeological treasures and priceless items of ancient Egyptian art. Plus, there was that mummification, which probably cost more than a year at a spa. Mereruka had invested the proceeds of his peak earning years in worm's meat. I was standing in his Aspen ski lodge, his Hamptons beach house, his Gulf Stream jet, the professional sports team he never owned, the college education of his kids. And in the end, Mereruka's tomb was never finished. Teti's successor, Pepi I, may have been one of those churlish brothers-in-law determined to get the deadwood out of the family business. There's a temptation to think that understating an ancient culture is easier, or at least less hectic, than understanding its contemporary offspring. The ancient culture holds still for inspection and doesn't produce new, confusing events such as a fresh episode of Survivor just after 3,000 people were voted off the island of Manhattan. But giant burial vaults can't have been an economically efficient investment of surplus capital. Riches could have been channeled into more productive use. Channeled literally, as in digging a canal across the flatland between the Nile Delta and the Gulf of Suez. But none was dug until after Darius, the Persian emperor, had conquered Egypt in the 6th century BC. Instead, when pharaohs wanted to trade along the Red Sea coast, they dismantled their boats, hauled them through the eastern desert, and put them back together. The Egyptians did not smelt iron. They didn't even discover bronze until the Middle Kingdom, 1,000 years after the civilization was founded. Irrigation was accomplished with buckets on the ends of long levers or by carrying pots slung from yokes. The water wheel wasn't introduced until the Persian invasion. And before the Persians, there wasn't such a thing as money. The ancient Egyptian technological innovation of note, besides the enormous triangular four-sided sepulchre stack, was papyrus paper. According to the Egyptologist Cyril Aldred, the ready availability of paper made the highly organized Egyptian state possible, for the privilege of living in which the Egyptian peasantry paid 50% of its produce in taxes. Even so, I felt that I emerged from Mereruka's tomb into a poorer, more woebegone country. Of course, I didn't. Egypt today has a per capita gross domestic product of $3,600. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development estimates that before the Industrial Revolution, world per capita GDP was about $650 in 1990 dollars. In 1820, Great Britain was the richest country on earth with a per capita GDP of only 1,756. In wealth per person terms, merry old England was a Ghana. The ancient world seems rich to us because its DVDs of Sex and the City have survived rather than its kinescopes of The Honeymooners. And disparities in income, so shocking to our contemporary sensibilities, can't have been less. Consider the negative net worth of the slaves. They didn't have a title to, or even a mortgage on, themselves. That said, in the fields and palm groves along the Nile are low mud houses of a kind unchanged since the days of Tete and Pepe. Identical homes are on display in miniature at the Egyptian Museum in Cairo, part of the Legoland of peasantry and servitude that was placed as an offering in a pharaoh's crypt. These Nile-side domiciles, in contrast to the City of the Dead, have been supplied with few electrical wires. Running water has in fact been taken away. Nile floods are now contained by the Aswan High Dam, and Egypt's fellaheen must use commercial fertilizer to do the job that muck did for eons. So the farmers, by the millions, move to Cairo, and between the remaining baked-earth homesteads rise the weekend villas of plutocrat Cairenes. The villas would do credit to any gated community in Boca Raton, but the villas are the product of a path to success unfamiliar to Boca, if not to Mararuca. "Who can afford these places?" I asked Peter, who has a Ph.D. in Egyptology, as does his wife. They struggle to support two kids. "Officials," he said, "and belly dancers." Other paths to success are steeper. Peter took me to one of the numerous carpet schools along the Memphis-Giza Road. Here, children age 10 and up were engaged in pedagogical alibis and apprenticeship hooey aside, child labor. Also, some of the children looked more like 8 than 10. There was nothing Dickensian about the well-lit, swept and airy ground floor full of looms. The manager said that the boys and girls were paid to give them encouragement, and that maybe they'll be able to get a job in the company's factory, although I had a feeling this was a factory. He assured me that his charges received academic instruction similar to that in the government schools, and maybe they do. Scribbled on one weaving frame was graffiti in English that read, "I will always be luling you." I watched little kid fingers move with blurring speed among warp and woof, and saw little kid faces puckered in grim expertise. I'll never buy a handmade rug again. Although I bought one, small, expectant eyes were upon me. "September 11 is like a black day to us," the manager said. "Is rug weaving really any worse than PlayStation 2? Maybe not. But since I got back from Egypt, wall-to-wall carpet made on automatic machines by unionized labor is looking better, the orange shag kind included. To blame Al-Qaeda on poverty like Egypt's is, as I had told Rona on the BBC, a slur on the poor. The September 11th attackers were taking flying lessons in America, not rug-weaving lessons in a village on the Nile. Yet there must be some economic or political-economic roots to the burning, flaming, bursting, exploding bush of current events. Fouad Ajami, the author of The Dream Palace of the Arabs and professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, has written, "Atta struck at us because he could not take down Mr. Mubarak's world, because in the burdened, crowded land of the Egyptian dictator there is very little offered younger Egyptians save for the steady narcotic of anti-Americanism and anti-Zionism." Narcotics aside, this very little offered raises a question about Arab culture. Why has Egypt and the whole Arab world made relatively little economic progress? Even the oil-flush Gulf states have not become rich the way we understand rich in the West. Kuwait is little more than an oil spigot with people sitting on top, and all they have to do is turn the tap. But Kuwait's per capita GDP is $15,000, while utterly resourceless Luxembourg's is $36,400. Egypt of yore may have been economically sclerotic, but modern Egyptians can't really blame their ancient civilization. At least they had a civilization, which is more than we did, or, to judge by daytime television, do yet. And Islam didn't destroy that civilization any more than the Persians, the Ptolemites, the Romans, and the Byzantines had before. The capitulation of Egypt to the Arabs was brokered by the Christian Patriarch of Alexandria in 642, on condition of security for persons and property, and with religious freedom guaranteed in return for payment of tribute. The Arab world began with a number of economic advantages besides tribute. It had a common language, a unified government, and territory that sat athwart the trade from the Orient to the Mediterranean, Z's strategic land bridge. To move goods by any other route was to risk, between the Mongols and the Deep Blue Sea, getting very wet or dead. The obligation of pilgrimage to Mecca stimulated commerce and encouraged the general public to travel the way nothing else would until the invention of frequent flyer miles and Disney World. A measure of law and order existed, unlike in Europe, where there was none, and in China, where there was too much. And Arabs had absorbed the learning of Greco-Roman civilization centuries before Europeans, in their Renaissance, began to pick scraps of it out of the ruin they had made of Greece and Rome. Also, the Islamic religion has the right attitude. In the Quran, Surah 2, verse 275 states, God hath permitted trade. The Quran orders the use of honest weights and measures, the fulfillment of contracts and the payment of debts. And one of the sayings attributed to Muhammad makes him not just the prophet of Allah, but the prophet of Adam Smith. Only God can fix prices. But something went wrong. How did the Arabs fall behind Europe, America, and now the Far East? It was probably nothing so air-filled as the experimental model and European rational thought, or the Protestant work ethic or Confucian values. Civilizations, like people, trip over smaller things. The answer may be as boring as a real estate title search. A title search, it may be noted, of real estate in the same neighborhood where the early Zionists were intent on buying. Caliphs and sultans did not bestow feudal lands on a hereditary nobility. Fiefs were generally temporary. Land was given to a particular person for a certain time in return for military or other services. Agricultural estates were your salary. You got a raise by squeezing everything you could out of them, and you had to do it quickly before you lost your job. There was no incentive to invest in the land, much less in the people who tilled it. This was a carnival concession. You were never going to see these rubes again. The dearth of private land in the Islamic world is of a piece with the excessive government centralization that has always plagued the civilizations of the Fertile Crescent. Farming in much of the area requires irrigation, a horribly communal activity, like being trapped in an endless Amish barn raising. Then the people of the region went and invented writing. Writing is the enabler of bureaucracy. Bureaucracy leads to government on the Department of Motor Vehicles model, with patronage jobs, wire pulling, and a political hack of a boss. The Muslim conquerors of the Fertile Crescent may have come from independent and roughly democratic Arab tribes, but they quickly glommed on to state power, as did their Seljuk and Ottoman Turk successors. Despite the laissez-faire prescriptions of the Quran and the Prophet's warnings against price controls, the Islamic State proceeded, like its predecessors, to interfere grossly with the economy. The preeminent Western historian of Islam, Bernard Lewis, estimates that Middle East agricultural yields began a decline in late Roman times that has continued almost to the present day. As for commerce, Lewis has written, governments seemed to have reasoned that if they could earn so much a year by taxing the pepper trade, they could earn even more by taking it over entirely. This works so well in Cuba. Lewis argues that Islamic commercial wealth was not destroyed by European innovations in ocean shipping. Rather, Europeans were driven to the sea lanes because in the 1400s, the Mamluk Sultan of Egypt nationalized the spice trade and forced the Kmart of nutmeg and ginger caravans into receivership. The economic decline can be measured by the number of people the economy was able to support. The Egyptian historian Afaf Marsot believes that the population of Egypt at the time of the Arab conquest was 20 to 30 million. By the late 1700s,